Godspeed Institute with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hollenbeck. Dr. Stuart Bitkoff grew up in New York City and spent most of his professional career living and working in the New York City area. He holds a doctorate in education and is an avid student of Sufi mysticism and the perennial philosophy. He is the author of A Commuter's Guide to Enlightenment and the new book, Sufism for the Western Seeker, which we will discuss at length today. Dr. Bitkoff is a frequent contributor to Sufism and Inquiry and Sacred Journey magazine and writes for multiple online entities, including the Philadelphia Spirituality Examiner, Wisdom Magazine, New Age Journal, and others. Stuart, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, I can relate to the challenge of finding peace in traffic, as you wrote about extensively in your first book, The Commuter's Guide to Enlightenment. I recall studying theology and religion at Fordham University in the Bronx, and I tell you, I've never had a relationship with the Sawmill Parkway that was at ease. So I'm sure there are folks out there who can relate to the stress of not only commuting but everyday living that you will be able to address with us today. So welcome to the program.
Well, and, thank you very much.
And I why don't we begin, I guess, with the beginning? What could you describe, because I know you're from New York, your early years in New York City, what borough did you live in, and what was the religious climate in those days?
The early years were spent between the Bronx and then Brooklyn, and then when I was about 6 or 7 years old, we moved to Manhattan, and I lived in Manhattan for till I was about 17, and then we moved to upstate New York. I found living in Manhattan, growing up in Manhattan, exhilarating in a lot of ways because there was a lot of freedom in those days. In those days, you didn't have to worry about getting mugged as often. Mm. The drugs hadn't started yet. And so as a young teenager, I can go and do all kinds of things. I used to play ball and do a lot of these things on my own. Nowadays, parents have to drive their kids to ball games and all kinds of activities.
Yeah.
And so living in Washington Heights, which was right next to the George Washington Bridge, was very positive in a lot of ways and negative in a lot of ways. In those days, in the late 50s, early 60s, we were just coming off of World War II, where the Holocaust had taken place. And so as being a Jew and growing up in a Jewish faith, there was a lot of talk still about that. A lot of relatives had died about that. Mm. And certainly my father had participated in the war. And we had pictures and all kinds of things about the horrible things that happened in the concentration camps. And in those days, living in Manhattan, groups were segregated, basically. There were streets and areas where Jews lived. There were streets and areas where the Catholic kids lived, and they went to Catholic school. And then Washington Heights bordered right on Harlem, and where black people lived. And in those days, groups stayed to themselves. You know, I found chosen people to be a bit arrogant, if you will.
Could you share more about that?
Because, you know, here I was that, and I was going to school and playing ball and working out with people from different faiths, different backgrounds. And the notion that if we were the chosen people by God, and that if you believed differently than that, bad things would happen to you, that didn't make sense to me. Because, you know, the people that I was meeting from the other neighborhoods and when I played sports and all of those kinds of things seemed nice enough. And if that there, in my mind, if there was a just God, why would he treat them any differently than he would treat us? Mm. And on top of that, the overlay on this whole thing is, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel, we were from the Kohanim, which were the priests. And so I had my grandmother filling my head with stories of my great-grandfather, who was a renowned philanthropist and rabbi in the old country before the Tsar took the land, and that, in our heritage, we were descendants from prophets. And those things didn't mean anything to me. I was growing up on the streets of Manhattan, and it was about survival, you know, on those streets. These old stories and these old traditions just didn't make it, as far as I was concerned. And so from religion, listening to the stories about Moses and listening to all of those kinds of things, it was just another time and another place. And here I was, we were coming out of Hebrew school, and the Catholic kids would be waiting for us behind cars and pound us with rocks and try to hit us with that. And then I would have to later on go track them down and beat them up, get back for what they were doing to me. Those kinds of things, those kinds of stories made little sense to me. You know, what made sense was here and now, growing up in, while it was a nice place to grow up, it was also intolerant and aggressive, very aggressive.
Well, gosh, thank you so much for sharing so much, Stuart. There's so much there in that story. Because on my father's side as well, they left Russia in 1917 and came to New York, and I imagine that's what you're referring to.
That's right.
When you're talking about the Tsar. And,
that's right.
And then, of course, in World War II, to bring along these events and stories and pictures so we don't forget, I imagine is intended to have meaning and context to our, you know, experience as family and in our faith. But from what I hear, it just didn't really address what you were experiencing in a modern-day New York City.
We're the chosen people. How come they're waiting outside with rocks to throw them at us?
Maybe not the kind of chosen you want to be.
Exactly.
So what were you hungering for then? I mean, it obviously...
I did not know. I mean, I had a regular family, a mother, a father, loved me, you know, all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I enjoyed sports. I was always in the advanced classes in school, although I did not apply myself because most of what I was learning in school really did not hold my attention. Math, science, all of those kinds of things were not the kinds of things I was looking for. So if I was to characterize the early part of my life, certainly up until the age of about 23, 24, I was lost. I didn't know what I wanted. There were some things I enjoyed for sure, sports, dating. And in those times, those were the 60s, there was a lot going on.
Yeah.
But I did not have anything inwardly to hold on to.
That's interesting. Yes. And so, but you somehow were aware of it.
Well, I was aware of it. I was in a lot of pain. I began writing poetry when I was 19, 20. I always felt like I was a little different because I could not enjoy or share or participate, at least at the emotional level, that lots of people did about things. I mean, I dated, you know, I had plenty of friends, but the connection was not there, that something was missing, and that emptiness. And it wasn't until later that was defined, you know, the inner emptiness.
Were you writing about that in your poetry?
I was just writing poems about being sad or the happy people or, you know, typical adolescent kind of poetry about, you know, or and I was writing about nature, the symmetry in nature, and that's where I realized I could write. I never really knew I could write till then, until a college teacher also helped me begin to structure things. Well, this is about my third year in college, and she spent a great deal of time individually with me helping me write. And I never realized I could do that until then.
Isn't that great to find a mentor like that?
Well, changed my life in a lot of ways.
So then how and when did you discover Sufism in this mix?
Well, by this time we had moved out of New York City, and we were living upstate Rochester, and I was going to school in Cortland State. And I was being trained as a therapeutic recreator, the healing profession. And right then the draft was going on, and I had filed to be a conscientious objector working in a psychiatric hospital because I had done my fieldwork study in a psychiatric hospital. And I felt I would be a better of use serving my country working in a psychiatric hospital, helping to heal people, than fighting. I just didn't think I could kill people at that point in my life. And so I had to go to a hearing in front of the draft board, and they gave me an occupational deferment, but the problem with it was I had to go back to New York to accept a job that I had already turned down. I had already been offered a job back in New York in the Bronx. I already turned it down, had to call the fellow back up and ask him if he was still available, and then I went back to New York to live, and I was totally depressed. I was depressed for months after that, having to go back to New York. But it turned out, in that hospital, I met my wife. I met many of my lifelong friends. I developed a career. And also, I met my spiritual teacher there.
Okay. So let's learn. Let's do some learning now. You met your teacher there. Now, in general terms, what did you find Sufism to be? And then also, what did it come to mean to you personally?
Well, first of all, I didn't know he was a Sufi. Well, a friend of mine said he had a spiritual teacher and he wanted to meet me because a friend of mine had been talking to him about me, so I went there for lunch. And at this point in my life, I didn't disbelieve in God or light or energy, but I certainly didn't believe in it either. I was postponing it. And so I met with him. And that day changed my life because basically what happened there was an energy in that room that lifted me up, turned me upside down, and just altered the course of my life. There was a spiritual energy. While he was answering every question I ever had about religion and why people fought from religion and all of those kinds of things, there was an energy in that room that was palpable, that was loving, and it lifted me up and changed me. And then as we kept coming back for more lunchtime visits, we were given books to read, and we were always told to read any of the holy books we wanted, to question everything that was being discussed. And then after a while, I began to realize that a lot of these books we were reading were Sufi books. But what we really talked about was the light, God, and being a servant of God, that the purpose of life was to serve yourself and serve humanity and serve God. And as we had those sessions for about 3.5 to 4 years. And in that process, there were any number of us who met our teacher. A lot of them thought he was crazy. A lot of them stuck with what he had to teach. And a lot of them just came for a quick cup of coffee and left. And then after a period of about 3.5 to 4 years, we were told that the teaching sessions were over and to get in contact with the Society for Sufi Studies out on the West Coast. And we were directed after a time to start reading the works of Idris Shah, and who died in 1996, and whose legacy is about 30 books that includes everything the modern Western student needs to know about traveling the Sufi path. Now, what Sufism means to me, basically, is it's a connection with an energy that gives life to the universe, and participate with that energy through my own inner knowing, my heart, and serve that energy.
It sounds as though the room that you describe and the energy, could that also be, did you feel joy in that energy?
You know, it's nowadays people call it getting high on God. We were every place, everywhere at the same time. There was no time and space. We were just on a current of energy that just lifted us up, and we were everywhere at the same time while we were in that room with the desk and chairs during lunchtime, and we were riding on this ocean of love, joy, and while we were ourselves, we were not ourselves. We were connected to that. We were part of that. And in that, in those moments, we knew there was no time. There was no time or space because we were everywhere at the same time. And through the meditations and the direction of the teacher and the different exercises, we were able to advance further along the path and open up our, our spiritual chakras and different experiences. We were given books to read. We were given exercises to do. And there were lots of things that happened.
Now, this is Sufism is it's in one part the mystical tradition of Islam, but that's not all it is. It's interesting to me how the mystical aspect or component of so many religions worldwide seem to be where people connect, whether it's the Franciscan spirituality or Buddhist spirituality or any other mystical, the Kabbalah traditions, that it's almost as though they're an antidote to what people consider of organized religion. I wonder if you could share a little bit on Sufism from that point of view, and then I'd like to go into your very practical wisdom.
Okay. First, Josh Shuan wrote a book called The Transcendent Unity of Religions, which talks about the inner current that you're what we're discussing. And in that book, Houston Smith did an intro, didn't it, which just was astounding. And what he did is he basically compared all the traditions. He drew a pyramid and said all the traditions at the lower bottom of the pyramid were different. But as you ascended to the top, the closer part of it, all the traditions became more and more alike. And what he was talking about was the inner reality. The external reality of religion is different because time and place and people are different. The internal reality, particularly as you get to the higher experiences, are essentially the same. And that inner experience is the lifeblood of the universe, is the light, the logos, whatever terminology we want to use it. And it's at that point, once people experience that, once they get past the day-to-day differences in religion and have a spiritual inner experience that lifts them up and changes them, they experience how all people are the same.
That's
the way I connect with what you're saying. And to me, that could be the saving grace in the world. Because once you change people's hearts, once they know inside themselves that we are all connected and experience it, it's like love. You can write a million love songs, write a million movies about love, but until you've been in love, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right, it's a
and
theory.
Then love changes. Love changes, you know, as you go along.
Yes.
And this inner experience is the same and different because we're all the same and we're all different.
Thank you so much for that answer. And love changes, life changes.
Right.
We change, and of course where it's important, you know, for us here, not only in the work that we do, but in life, is the spirituality where the rubber meets the road, as it were, to use a sort of pun there, regarding your book.
Commuting. Yeah.
You know, so for years, you, for example, you suffered through every traffic jam, flat tire, rude driver that marred a long commute to New York City until you discovered how to transform this soul-draining journey into one filled with divine lessons and meaning. And that's what we call where the rubber meets the road, Stuart.
Because
if you can cull divine lessons from the kind of road rage that is out there to help another traveler on their journey, especially on the sawmill.
Right, yeah,
I did the vegan.
Sometimes I would take the sawmill down to the vegan. But
yeah.
You're right, it's brutal.
That's a heck of a gift to the world.
It's a war zone, you know, basically.
Yeah, so why don't we, you know, get into that book a little bit here. If you could share some of your insights from the Commuter's Guide to Enlightenment. We'll talk more about your new book in the second part of the program, but I'd like to share some of this because I find it, you know, very helpful, I'm sure, to many people.
Well, what we're talking about, at least in the terminology that I use, is everyday spirituality or spirituality of the marketplace. you know, if spirituality is such a hot and great thing, well, how is it useful in everyday life? That's the question.
Right.
You know, we got all of these gurus, all of these people writing these great books about stuff.
Right.
Well, if it's really that cool, okay, let's put it to a test. All right? One day, I just found myself as I was driving to work. So, you know, my inner heart was singing. I was all at peace. Everything was going on, and I would find myself doing this more and more. And this was on parts of the road that I was familiar with, where there was no stop and go or people cutting me off. So I found myself at certain times realizing that it was possible to do any number of things on this commute, like in life. I mean, sometimes life really kicks you. Other days, it's beautiful. And what I found, what I began to realize was, if I had an expectation that my commute, now pardon the word, sucked, that would be the way I'd wake up in the morning, and that's what I would expect to anticipate going to work. So even before I got on the road, I had my blood pressure up, I had all these other things going on.
And your attitude.
That's right, because my expectation was this was something I dreaded and didn't want to do. So what I came to realize was that I needed a neutral position. Yes, some days it was like that. I needed to be prepared for those days. I needed to know all the off-ramps, you know, have a phone that I can call if I was coming late to work, have something to listen to on the radio that I liked or on the tape player that I liked. But if I had an expectation, a mindset that this was pure drudgery, I was dead. So I began to realize that flexibility of thought was necessary here, because I had some days where I was singing. My heart was aglow. I was going to work. I was doing work I loved. I was going into the city. I was going to help make the world better from my point of view.
Yeah.
And that was like the journey of life. That's what we get up each day to do.
But then there's the tailgater.
Well, then there's the tailgater, and what happens with that is that the primitive part of our brain kicks in. The fight or flight response kicks in. It's automatic. We can't do anything about that. When somebody cuts you off or tailgates you, your fight or flight response goes into play. And you have 1/6 of a second, psychologists tell us, whether to react or not. Flip the bird, curse, or whatever.
Right.
So by presenting that information to drivers, they can begin to think about that. I have 1/6 of a second here now whether to, you know, hit my brakes, flip the bird, do whatever I want. And sometimes if I did react that way, I had to forgive myself for reacting that way because it was inborn reaction. And the different pages of this book explore lots of things. Because I grew up around that area also, I can talk about how the times have changed, what these different roads meant to me, all of those, and sort of like I invite the reader to come. Let's go. Come along with me on my commute. Let's go to work. And this commute in this presentation is a series of rides to work over a period of months. And where all kinds of things happen. Good things happen, bad things happen. And the point of it all is life is a journey. We wake up each day, we go out into the world, we create our life and our day, and then the day ends. And with the commute, it's a very similar thing. We get up, go to work, we'll get on the highway and try to get to work. Now, what I do at that time, what I do with each moment of that time, is up to me. What I came to realize is that we create life moment by moment. In each moment, we have the opportunity to rise higher or sink lower. So if somebody cuts off in front of me, and I know my fight or flight response is going to kick in, so I curse, but I don't have to go after him if I know that I have 1/6 of a second to make a decision about this. So in this case, information is important. Like rubbernecking, this rubbernecking thing that everybody does, you can't help but not do it. Because that's the way we were honed from millions of years. If something unusual happened in our environment to protect ourselves, our eyes immediately went to it. So when you see thousands of people rubbernecking, or hundreds of people rubbernecking, instead of cursing and saying, my God, why are all these people slowing down, realize It's instinctive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and in part, it may not be our worst nature, but something deeper and more compassionate about looking to each other is if when there's something wrong as well. I learned because we moved up to coastal Maine shortly, actually just a few weeks before 9/11, and my pace, you know, was still very much quicker than those around me for some time. That changed over some years. But I remember, you know, the kind of stress I felt being in a car behind someone who I thought was going too slowly.
Right.
And, you know, the thing I put myself through, you know, in that position and the stress until I realized, well, you know what, if I take a bird's eye view on this, maybe I'm supposed to be behind this person for a reason. Maybe this is an elderly person who's going to have a problem a few miles ahead, and I'll be there. And I just found, you know, just taking a different point of view that people aren't necessarily just obstacles, as we tend to think of them on the road.
That's right. Doing it on purpose to
annoy
me. Or doing it on purpose to annoy me. They're going
exactly.
Slow just so they can mess with me.
You're getting in my way.
Right.
So then, you know, so the Commuter's Guide to Enlightenment, what does it offer the other travelers that are traveling in their lane at their own pace?
What it offers is a number of things. You know, we did something called the Deegan Project where we gave out free copies to commuters at Grand Central Station and a lot of key places out here, even in the Poconos we gave them out. And I was surprised how many people pray while they drive.
Mm.
They do that all the time. For them, you know, pray for their kids, pray for themselves, help that they don't lose their mind going to work, and that people are finding this out more and more. What the book offers is a pretty practical way of looking at your commute. The part that seems, you know, hairy-fairy there, and I had some people comment about that. You know, my commute is never like that. Why? I think he's just making this up to sell a book. It's a potential. You know, this potential to get something out of commute can happen under certain circumstances. You're in the middle lane, traffic is flowing, you know where you're going. You have 5 minutes, 8 minutes where your mind can do something else. Listen to music, say a prayer, do all kinds of things. That doesn't mean that the commute won't change instantly later. Also, there are exercises in there that were given, you know, traditional exercises, prayers that were given, and also monitoring your thought activities, because the number one thing we were taught in this mystical school was at the end of the day to monitor our thoughts so that the next day when those thoughts repeated, we could have an option of what to do, to record them and see what kind of things keep showing up. You know, it's a terrible thing to hate something.
Yeah.
To wake up every day and say, I hate this damn ride to work.
Yeah, especially when it's a part of your daily life.
Well, if you have no choice.
Yeah.
What if that's the only job you can have?
And there's only one way to get there.
That's right. In my case, that was.
Yeah.
I would have been happy to have been on a bus or been on a train where I could kick back and go to sleep and do those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So I had to deal with all of those kinds of things. And when I was growing up in Manhattan, I watched them build the Cross Bronx Expressway, where they tore down the buildings where my friend lived across the street. Mm. They dug out the underneath. And every Friday night, I'd see thousands of people backed up in traffic going to New Jersey. Also, at the time, my father commuted from Brooklyn by car, and he was always coming home after a two-hour commute.
Yeah.
And I swore to myself I would never become a commuter.
But well, life has a way,
window,
right?
Well, what I learned from that is, you know, life has a way of doing things to you that you don't want to do, and you have to be flexible sometimes.
Yes, and you've certainly taken the experience and found a gift in it. We are about halfway through the program now, Stuart.
Okay.
We're just going to take a short break. Hang on. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We are going to take a short break, but when we return, we will continue our great conversation with Dr. Stuart Bitkoff, author of Sufism for the Western Seeker. Let's spend a couple of minutes with George Harrison now. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Kara Hallenbeck, and that was George Harrison with a favorite awaiting on you all. We're speaking with Dr. Stuart Bitkoff, author of Sufism for the Western Seeker. And welcome again, Stuart. In the second part of our program, we'd like to focus more on your latest work, Sufism for the Western Seeker. And I just want to begin with a quote from the book. For many Western spiritual seekers, Sufism is often misunderstood and viewed as an Islamic mystical tradition presented through various Sufi orders. Yet this ancient path of spiritual knowing is much broader and older. Could you please share about this?
Sure. What we're talking about, what my teacher basically said early on, was what he was teaching us or showing us or having us experience was the religion before there was religion. You know, what does that mean, religion before there was religion? And in the Quran, it talks about Abraham looking up at the sun and the moon, Abraham being the father of the three monotheisms,
yep,
Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and refusing to bow to the sun or the moon. What was his religion before then?
That's a good question.
Did he experience before there was such a thing mm-hmm. as Islam, Judaism? And it was surrender to something higher and connection with an experience of something higher. So people like Aldous Huxley and other people call this the perennial philosophy. Once again, we're talking about an esoteric, an inner experience and connection with something. Now, all this learning started for me in the 1970s. And my teacher, I didn't realize, was a Muslim to 3 years into the teaching, because it wasn't related to what we were doing. So I began reading the Quran. Must have read the Quran 20 times. And in it, I found that it was just the third of books. There was the Old Testament, the New Testament, and this was the final one in the group. Muhammad was called the seal of the prophets, the last of the monotheistic prophets. And I found nothing in it as a Jew that bothered me, because what I was taught was that each of these revelations were locked into time, place, and culture. The external presentation was locked into a time capsule, and then it decayed. But that the inner current, which was the esoteric, the Sufi, if you will, presentation, was always being updated by a living master, always being updated every day, and that there were teachers, and this way of living and learning was available in every town, every city in the world.
Yes.
It was the inner current of religious teaching. And that's what I came to understand that, and that was long before this phobia about Islam, this phobia about Muslims, all began here in this country.
Yeah, that's an important point. The phrase, "Behold, I make all things new," came to my mind, too, when you were speaking there. Before we move on to the phobia,
right.
Were you surprised, because it said it took you years to learn that the tradition of your teacher was Muslim?
Three years.
And how did you feel at first about that?
Well, don't forget, I was not looking for anything. I wasn't looking for a spiritual teacher. This was like a call to me, and I was going to graduate school. I was a doctoral candidate, you know. And so what I learned was to experience things. And also he taught us to go to, you know, New York. It had connections with all kinds of spiritual masters. He said, go to all of them. Listen to what they have to say. Read all the books. I read the Book of Mormon. I read the Upanishads. I read all of them. Read all of them. Don't believe anything I tell you. Go out and experience it yourself. And we were taught to use our own inner yardstick because we were shown what that was.
Mm. And that's important.
We were shown inside how to know truth.
Yeah, that's a mature spirituality.
That's right. And what he said was, if you study this way, you'll go back to the religion of your birth and become a better Christian, Jew, Muslim, whatever.
Thank you. Now, you write in your book that religion is being used as a smokescreen for a power play. Can you share more about this important viewpoint, perhaps in relation to the phobia you mentioned earlier?
Sure. Idris Shah was a very important teacher, although a lot of people don't realize that. And he died in 1996. And basically in his book, The Sufis, he talked about the Crusades, the real reason for the Crusades from his point of view. And what he said was, it wasn't about who owned Jerusalem, these holy places. The Crusades were really fought about trade routes. It was fought about property. Who owned what? Now, I've grown up in America watching all these things on TV. I'm thinking, okay, all these guys went there to save the holy city from the Muslims, you know, and all of this and all of that. And it was really about trade routes, power, personal vendettas.
Green.
And once again, as our teacher said, don't accept anything anybody puts down in a book. Run it through yourself. And then when I thought back to growing up in the streets of New York City and the kids throwing rocks at us, or how my family would put down another group of people. You know, when you put down a group of people, you're doing that to make yourself feel better. All right? And that people always come up with reasons to have a war that are not truthful. It's always about power and money. Because when you ask the average person who has to go fight these things, they don't want to do this.
No. I know. There was a general from World War II who did a study who actually found 95% of the world's population felt the way you did, and could not imagine killing anyone, even an enemy standing in front of them.
That's right. And I had that experience when I was 19 or 20, and I couldn't do it. And so I got this alternate service. And so as I read other people, talked to other people, met other people, here was this man teaching me about God. The rabbis couldn't do this. And he was a Muslim. You know, I love the man.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you get your wisdom where you find it, and it sounded like what he was presenting to you also had a lot to do with life and the energy of life.
Yeah, he called it the light, the light. Yeah. You know, the light of God, because it dissipates darkness.
Another quote from your book that I caught is, he that is purified by love and he that is absorbed in the beloved and hath abandoned all else is a Sufi. And I love that quote because, of course, the mention of the beloved, and because of that, I see that bottom line, or as you say, the top of the pyramid, purity of intent and living and heart, you know, the Sufi, the heart of wool.
That's right.
I see in that quote, you know, the best of all faiths and the best of anything we can aspire to be in our life. Can you share a little bit more about your practice of Sufism, and if you have indeed a favorite aspect?
Okay, let me go back to the quote a little bit.
Sure.
And what I came to realize was that that state that they're talking about there, that definition that they're talking, in most people is transitory. We live in the world. We have an everyday consciousness, which requires us to do things. The baby's crying. I have to stop what I'm doing and go change her, feed her. And while I may have just been in a mystical state and maybe I can carry it over to taking care of the baby, that probably won't be the best way to do that. All right? So what I came to realize, and you don't see this so much in a lot of the writings, is that these kinds of states, these kinds of levels of awareness come and go as needed in a situation. All right, so what I came to realize was that spirituality was an added dimension to life that most people had not I guess, actualized or had not really opened themselves to. So most of humanity, if we were a car, were still stuck in second gear,
yeah.
Couldn't go into third gear. So what this training taught me and this perspective taught me was that there was a part of myself that already knew this. It had to remember all of this again and awaken it so I could be of better use to myself, my family, and my world. Now, my favorite practices, as I was looking at that, is I often find myself just going through the day. They use the word dikkha, is a Sufi word. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it properly. A remembrance. And what I do is I repeat the name of God. I do an inhaling and an exhaling with the name of God. I do Allah, Allah, and I repeat that over and over. And each time I repeat that name, I change my consciousness. So if I was worrying about something, for that 3 seconds or the 10 seconds I keep repeating that name, my consciousness has now shifted to something higher. You know, that's one of my favorite things I do throughout the day. Call the name of God all day long. You know, as I walk and I do all kinds of things, I vacuum, I call the name of God while I'm vacuuming. I'm vacuuming the house because the house will look better and people are coming over. And they will enjoy themselves better. You know, that's everyday spirituality. Same thing driving to work. I used to do that all the time.
But that's so much the important thing because, you know, even awakened, the practice, the daily practice within our daily life seems to be the almost more challenging part because even, you know, for years, the people I've seen come on retreats, you know, retreats that I've led or retreats that I've attended elsewhere, it's as though, you know, yes, you get the opportunity to go into this almost magic bubble that is very peaceful and focused and everyone is on the same page about, you know, their intent for the retreat. And it's almost about the second they get back in the car and they hit the driveway and the cell phone comes out, it is almost like seeing people pull out of this plug and plug in to that different energy, which can be very fragmented and harsh. It's almost like changing your song, you know, from this kind of symphony or lullaby to that kind of, you know, hard rock, as it were, back in the world. Sharing is so important because it's that practice that keeps you remembering, I think, that is the... You know, once you have the foundation, then you know, how do you build?
Well, then you need contact with people who already know how to do that. And that's what I've tried to do with the book, is present that opportunity to people to let them know there is a way to do that. Another thing that the prayer that I have is, you know, it comes from the opening stanza of the Quran. O Lord, I surrender myself to you. I open myself to your will. Help me through this day. So if this day is a day of help me through this day and meet with my boss and that the outcome will be positive for both of us, or, oh, Lord, I surrender myself to you. Help me go to the hospital today and be of good cheer when I visit my wife there. You know, those are everyday spirituality kinds of things. And it's a prayer, oh, Lord, I surrender myself to you, because what it does is it works as a radio receiver. It changes your vibration and pulls into you the other vibrations that are out there that come from, you know, the unseen forces and the center of the universe that sends out this universal energy. And the Sufis are the guardians of this energy that bring it into the world every day. At least that's the tradition. And so when you tune yourself to this energy, you're changing your consciousness. You know, I've just offered two concrete examples. There are many more. There are some in the book on how to do all of this. And, you know, I'm available to answer questions for people if somehow they find their way to my door or they email me. And the point of the book is to share this. Look, here is a way to do this. You know, we've forgotten it. Mm. Once you remember it, you'll know it's true. You know, one of my favorite stories was that I went home at lunchtime to meditate, and I went home to visit my oldest daughter, who was an infant, and my wife. I live very close to the hospital. And it was so noisy and the kids crying, and I got to get back to work. I got an hour to eat and do all of this. So I get back into the car, and just before I take off to go to the hospital, because it's only 10 minutes away, I start saying the prayer and start meditating. And as I'm doing this, I get zapped with an energy that just burnt me. It was like I put my hand into an electric socket, and I just got singed. It never happened like that before. Always it was a source of joy. So later that afternoon, at the end of the day, I went to see Sam. That's the teacher's name that I use in the book.
Right.
And I walked in his office, and he looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, you know, sometimes the teacher has to be careful where he reflects the light.
And what did he mean by that?
Well, he didn't explain things like that.
He left that
for you to figure it out. But having just been singed by the light, I knew what he wanted. Knew what he was talking about, is that he was reflecting it to me, you know, helping me grow, but there was too much of a dose at that point.
Mm.
And what that taught me was that this energy was living, it was vibrant, it was part of us, it was part of the heritage of humanity to learn how to use this to make the world better.
Mm. Now, while we're talking about making the world better, another quote in your book is this: it was man who was responsible for much of the chaos and suffering on this planet. This was a choice to hurt rather than help, which was being made each day by individual travelers. Can you share a little more about free will and this world that we help create?
Absolutely. Each of us is born with free will choice, but what does that mean? It means that in our day-to-day, many of the things that we can do are really up to us. But what happens is we all grow up in a society and within a framework, within a family, and there's conditioning. Now, when I was growing up, we were conditioned to go work corporate America, get married, have a house in the suburbs and drive into the city, have two kids and a white fence. That was the conditioning. Hmm. Now, when I went out to the Southwest to visit my brother in New Mexico, his kids were being conditioned to start their own businesses. They didn't have to go to college.
Hmm.
They could work out of the house. You know, everybody had to take care of themselves, but how you do that? And what I learned from all of this, and what the Sufis basically say, well, people don't like to use the word Sufis, by the way. I didn't go into that, but go into that in the book. But what the Sufis say basically is that you have to free yourselves from the expectations of society and of yourself. You have to learn to see clearly what is in front of you. And most of us are hazed over by that. You know, we have to make money. We have to do this. I need X amount of money to live happily. All of these things are indoctrinated into us, either by ourselves or society, particularly the television and the news media, a lot of these things. But we have each moment we have a choice to make because we live moment by moment. And in the moment, the question becomes, the whole divine plan is revealed. The divine plan is basically, are you going to reach higher and make the most out of this moment, or are you going to stay where you are or regress? And free will choice exists to help us do that. We were created according to the Quran and according to the Old Testament as God's representative on earth. We were created in the image of God, which means we are gods, and which also means, or God-like, that we can create things. And so in each moment we have the opportunity to create our life. Now within that framework, there are certain fixed things. We're born, we die. Sometimes marriage is in the middle. Sometimes you're destined to be a doctor. You're destined to be something else. But day to day, moment by moment, it's free will choice. Now, if you look at our country, there's a surplus of food, plus everybody's fat and overweight. How come there's still hungry people in America?
Yeah.
because people are choosing not to feed those people. There are a lot of people who are feeding those people in soup kitchens, but it hasn't reached the level where everybody collectively is saying is that this is nonsense. And so I say the problems of the world are created by man collectively. There's not enough people here yet. We haven't reached the tipping point where these things will change. We're getting closer.
Yeah.
So yes, I don't know if that answers the question.
Yes, we are. Thank you so much. As we come toward the end of our program, I wanted to ask if people want to learn more about your work, where should they go and find your terrific books?
Well, all three of the books are up on Amazon. So all I have to do is punch in Bitkoff, my last name, B-I-T-K-O-F-F, and it'll show what books are up there, all three of them. And then also I have a new blog, and it's www.stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, Bitkoff, B-I-T-K-O-F-F.com. Now, for the last 2 years, I've been writing articles all over the place and e-zines all over the place. So if you punched in my name, Stuart Bitkoff Sufi, in Google, you would see all the different things that I've written over the last couple of years.
Yes, thank you very much. And I visited your blog, and it's a really worthwhile read, so I recommend that to our listeners. And finally, from Stuart's book, I'm going to sum up here a few directions. Love God, be a citizen of the universe, align with the highest, love another, live fully, seek excellence, be yourself, help others, do good deeds, practice gratitude, and travel beyond teachings. Stuart Bitkoff, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Keir, for having me on the program. Enjoyed it very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope to speak again in the future, and keep us posted on
the
book.
Okay, and I hope we answered some questions that people might have out there.
Oh, we certainly did. We certainly did. And in fact, before we close, I'd like to share something from my first book, Dear Little One, Thoughts to My Child in an Uncertain World, which I wrote while commuting on Metro North while I was expecting my first child. This reflection is called Enjoy Right Where You Are. There are times when you become so frustrated, when you want to do what the bigger kids do and you cannot. Your mind knows how to do so many things, yet your body is not quite ready. Your motor skills are just a heartbeat behind your agile mind, and you cry. Enjoy right where you are in life. Remember, you're exactly where and when you're supposed to be. There will always be bigger and smaller kids. There will be those who appear swifter, smarter, and further ahead. And there are those who will appear to move more slowly than you, those whom you perceive to lag behind. These are some of the illusions of this world. The truth is, beauty, wisdom, and mastery reside in all of us at any given time, including you, child, even in trying moments. Know this, when you are able to live, learn, and love from right where you are, you will be liberated to experience real joy. Then your joy will enable you to fulfill a higher human function, to be a loving bridge between all those bigger and smaller kids, just by being your true self. Thank you so much for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. Our guest was Stuart Bitkoff. The show was engineered by Willie McGee and produced by Michael and Emma Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.